You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. With more than 30 weekly podcasts, Heritage Radio Network has something for every food lover. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. Handcrafted, expert approved, with over 20 international blind tasting awards. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
Hi, it's Sam. A few months ago, I moderated a panel at the Raw Wine Fair in New York titled Exploring the Natural Wines of Dalmatia. This region in coastal Croatia is producing some of the most interesting and delicious wines today. I spoke with two people at the forefront of these wines, Krešo Petrković from Vina Smora and Marko Kovač from Babić Winery, and also the creator of Karakteri. Give a listen to this special episode of The Grape Nation. You'll be compelled to try these wines. All right, so welcome to Raw Wine Spring 22. Welcome to the Speaker's Corner. Today we'll be exploring the natural wines of Dalmatia. It's an historic wine region in the south of Croatia on the Adriatic Sea in Eastern Europe. Wine has been produced there for thousands of years and have some of the oldest continually cultivated vineyards. It is also one of the four main wine regions of Croatia. So our guest today to help me guide you through all of this is Krešo Petrković. That's a mouthful. From Vina Smora and Marko Kovač from representing Babić Winery. So we're going to explore the region by tasting and discussing these six wines. So the best way to relate to everything is to taste the wines. All right, but before we get started, I think to set up a little context for everybody, I want each of you guys to take a few minutes to give us a little background on who you are, where you're at, what you're doing. So this way going forward, everyone knows, you know, what's going on. So, Krešo, we'll start with you.
Okay.
Is that on?
I think so.
Yes.
Well, welcome everybody. I think I know a bunch of people here. You'll hear me say the same thing again, but these are new wines for us, for Vina Smora, the first vintage we released. I've been, a lot of you know, but I've been working in New York for a long time selling wines and now importing wines as well with ZRS wines. And about 6 years ago, I made my first vintage in the north of in the continental part of Croatia with my dad. It's a small winery. And then in 2020, I went away for the pandemic. And, I was just about when I was having my best part of my life and could relax for the first time in I don't know how long, I started a new winery, which was a quite a historic moment for our region. Our region is one of the in Primošten vineyards, we have self-called Grand Cru area for Babić grapes, growing out of these incredibly dense limestone rocks, very mountainous terroir almost. And I didn't want it to fail as a cooperative that was there for 40 years buying grapes for a lot of these small growers, was going out of business, and they've called me to help. And I thought helping would be just making, buying little bits. And then I realized that doesn't make any sense. You can make a little bit of wine and it's just more work for you at the end. You have to be able to, have some sort of a mass to sell. And And we realized that we have to almost save the region. And that was how this Vinyas Mora was born. It was born of an idea to really save the terroir. And then the second was really how to make really great wine.
Vinyas Mora is a bunch of guys that are not a bunch of ordinary guys. Just tell me who you're
exactly. Well, wine. Yeah. So Vinyas Mora is essentially myself and Nico and another partner who is managing some of the work for us. And Nico is also Marco's partner at Caractère Wine Fair. If you ever go to Central Europe, to Vienna, to the fair, they do a tremendous fair. And you know, we had a very interesting point. So when I started Vinyas Mora, I said, we're going to partner and call our friends who are importers, you know. So I want to start selling tickets before the show, you know. So everybody kind of like, you know, Nico really was interested, and Marco helped us tremendously, and a few other people like invested a little bit of money. But really, there's only three partners in this winery. I'm the winemaker. You know, I kind of like didn't plan this to happen to me because I was really trying to grow the other winery, but I realized, at the moment when we started to do this, I really have to put this as a priority because it's a very unique project, and I really wanted it to survive. And we ended up making some really interesting wines, I think.
Which we're going to taste.
Yes.
All right, Marco, just give us a little background on what you're doing.
Thank you, Sam. Welcome. My name is Marco Kovac. I'm the founder of Caractère Wine Salon, which has now been going on for almost 10 years. We're based out of Austria, Vienna. There's a certain purpose to that because we focus almost exclusively on the wines of Central and Eastern Europe. And a lot of wineries, of which we have 120 this year on a show that will take place on the 19th of May, have actually grown with us. So we started the show 2011, and Ro was an inspiration. We wanted to do something regionally in Croatia. Eventually switched to Austria, and Vienna is the biggest metropolis, like near, close to us, and a beautiful place with beautiful, beautiful flight connections, so the whole world could come. And the first salon we had, I think, 10 or 20 producers out of Central and Eastern Europe, and now we're like six times that. So all of that, those people grew with us, and we grew with them. They found importers all over the world, which actually helped to bring back awareness of the fact that the region of Central Eastern Europe is actually a historic winemaking region, which people were not really, you know, aware of, especially focusing on France and Italy, but countries like Austria, Czech, Slovak, Hungary, Croatia, and Slovenia, just historic wine nations. I promote wines and sell wines in Southeast Asia, and that's about it for the moment, I think. And I'm actually here presenting Domaine Bibic this time
around. Which we're going to talk a little about. I think what we should do is everyone's been poured two wines. I think Marco, guide us through what's in front of us. Let's talk about the wine, the grape, a little about the winemaking, and then we'll all get a chance to throw it over our tongues.
I think it's good to consider, before that, I think it's good to consider a bit of like modern history on Croatia. Just to give a perspective.
I thought you would do that while we were drinking.
We can.
So here, then help create a snapshot of Dalmatia for everyone. Talk about location, climate, soils, and maybe start with a little history of the region.
I think it's good to look back into the 19th century, like the mid-19th century, where basically you had phylloxera in France. Croatia didn't have it until 50 years later on, which meant that basically Croatia was the winemaking, grape-growing region for France. At that point, people were exporting wines from Dalmatia, the region that we'll taste today, exporting the wines and grapes to France and supplying the wines of France. Croatia has, what is now Croatia, has a long history of wine growing, dating back before Christ, when you had the Greeks making wine, and then you had the Romans making wine, and basically Croatian vineyards were supplying the Roman court. So that's the brief history, which, you know, again, people are not aware of, but Croatia is very much the old wine growing world. Domaine B, which is actually located together with Vinas Mora, actually the two wineries are very close, like half an hour between apart from each other. And they're located in what is actually the heart of the wine growing region. What you have in two glasses in front of you, on your left, or with the lighter color, you have a blend of five varietals, two of which are international, that's Chardonnay and Pinot Gris. And then you have three local varieties, Maraschino, Poship, and Debit. And it's no chance that you have a blend. Following the Second World War, the industry decided that they were going to plant international grapes. Up until the 1920s, the 1930s, the region was all about local grapes like Maraschino, like Poship, like Debit, which you will taste in a few iterations today. Following the Second World War, and when the post-war industry became, you know, more cooperatives, they decided that it was better for the region to plant international varietals. So this wine kind of represents two connections in history, like more modern history where you have international varietals, but then also the origins of what are truly Croatian grapes. The winery, Bibic Winery, decided to keep both. They, of course, focus now on the local grapes as something which is unique to the region. But they decided to keep international varietals, which you also taste in the reds. The right one that you have on your hands is wine called Žutina, which is a kind of a slang in Croatian. It means yellow. This is a 90-day skin contact and a vinification between stainless and then bits of oak. Again, skin contact and a long skin contact like this of 3 months is something which is a very traditional winemaking process in Dalmatia, which you all maybe you best know of from the region of Friuli and produces like Princić or Radikon. But that's been the winemaking style of the whole, like the Adriatic coast and Mediterranean in general, where basically people did not really spend or have money to spend on chemicals. They just said, well, we might as well extract whatever is there from the skins and the grapes and just protect the wines with that. That's your second wine in the glass.
All right, so Krešo, the grapes are growing on what type of soils? Is it varied region by region? Talk about the climate a little. Mm-hmm. You know, when you pick, I mean, because you're in a Mediterranean, you know, area, do you pick later, earlier?
It's very, very different. So we have two, I mean, really, really different wine regions here with Bibic and Vinas Mora. Vinas Mora is very coastal. It's Vinas Mora means wines from the sea in Croatia, which I really wanted to represent what we are surrounded with. And it has a huge influence on the wines. Of course, you have the influence of the sea in Bibic, but Bibic is much more inland. They are 300 meters above sea level. There is a lot more fertile soil here. There is also quite a bit cooler weather here. I was leaving the domain in last January, and it was just absolutely like hailing and snowing, and it was insane. And then we drew to Vinas Mora, and it was warm, you know? So very, very different. This region was known for, like I said, like producing like a lot of bulk wines in the old Yugoslavia. It had a big tradition also with local varietals. Some of the varietals grown there are very different. Plavina, Lacin, Debit, Maraschino are four of them that are growing, but the focus mostly being on white varietals here. Debit, where Bibic is really the focus of all the domain in many different iterations, what you're actually tasting in this saccharine macerated wine. So what we see around here, and it's something that I always, you know, beat this topic, that we have tremendous density of the soil. Terroir here is unique. We have this push of tectonic plates from the Alps to Dinara Mountains, and then the Adriatic Sea pushing in with and creating these extremely complex soils. In my case, this basically our terroir looks like a mountain of rocks with almost zero organic matter. And the wines are absolutely extreme to that point that we have UNESCO protected vineyards, and this is something that is very rare in any place. So that's for Vinas Mora. Obviously,
We produce many different terroirs, and this is the subject that I wanted to do. I wanted to produce single vineyard wines from these extreme locations. And Bibic has concept of producing wines, blends from also different locations, but in a more of a blending style and et cetera. I don't think that explains it, but.
But the soils at Bibic, are they distinctly different?
Yes.
You talk about a lot of stones.
Yes, so exactly. So the stone here, you don't see it. As I said earlier, I don't know if I was clear. There is quite a bit more organic, fertile soil. There's more red clay base. There is a lot more soil here. The vines here are trained. They're not bush vines for most case. It is limestone, but crushed limestones. So much more what you see around it's in general areas of the Mediterranean. Still very poor soil. You have a natural lower yielding aspect in all of these wines. It's also an ideal place to produce wines with low intervention because there's a lot of wind. Like I said, there's very little disease. The only problems we have for us is lack of water, you know, so we rely on the actual snow coming from the Dinara Mountains, which are almost separating the continental and the coastal Croatia. What kind of snowfall we have during the year, and then those waters will soak the underwater canals. So we have no rainfall sometimes for 8 months, which is absolutely extreme. So the vines are really relying for these underwater canals, and they are very much extracting the minerality, what's in the soil, etc., which you definitely see in the wines. At Bibic, there is a more generous rainfall. There is a little bit of a cooler climate. It's not as extreme. And like I said, more organic matter, more red clay, and smaller limestone rocks than you find in the coastal.
All right, so let's taste through these wines. We have at least four more wines to taste, so we can't stay static with our glasses half full. Quick question about these wines. The two wines, we're talking about six, seven different varietals?
The two wines we're talking, yeah, five varietals in the first one.
So go over the varietals again.
Maraština.
Okay.
Poship.
POSIB.
Poship. And Debit on the whites. On the local Croatian ones, and then you have Chardonnay and Pinot Gris on the internationals. And then the second one will be 100% Debit. A wine which basically is a kind of a, you know, remnant of the old times. This is the wine that people produce for themselves for like daily consumption. Like if you go to Georgia, every house produces a wine just for themselves. Very similar in Croatia. People would actually produce this type of wine for themselves. They would never sell this, like in the ex-Yugoslavia, in the communist times. They would never sell this. This would be like a house wine. This is what you drank yourself. You didn't add any sulfur. You didn't add any chemicals. You wouldn't want to poison yourself. This is not what you sold. What you sold was an international varietal, which you sold to the cooperative. And that's how you made a living. This was something which was drank on a daily basis for lunch or for dinner, and basically something you had in like the back of the cellar. So skin contact, again, something which is quite a historic vinification technique in that part of the world. And I think in this case, it kind of shows, like beautifully shows the characteristics of the Debit grape, to be honest.
So just to mention, so Debit is a iteration of like a Bombino grape, something that's similar in that world. If you want to just relate it to something, Maraština is a iteration of Malvasia that is grown here. It's very small, thick-skinned grape with lots of. It's almost like I call it the Cabernet of the whites for us. It's really, it gives you this wonderful aromatics that you will find in some. Especially like in the wine I have, it really kind of like, it's a key element in the wine for me because of this Mediterranean aspect of the perfume that it produces, these aromatics. So just so you have a little, and Poship, I don't even know. It's a strange grape with like lower growing season that the alcohol producing and higher aromatics as well.
So I have a question. So you guys are considered newer age winemakers, but working in an old historic region. We've poured two wines already, and we're talking about five or seven varietals. Are you bringing back varietals that either were not planted or unpopular because you see the potential, you know, or it wasn't as commercial?
There was a moment in the salon that we did Caractère a few years back, and Crescio, Nico, and I, we spoke, and 5 years back, you would find like two Croatian wineries at our event. Our event has kind of a strict criteria for participation, and we said, well, we need to do something to bring the whole country, you know, to its feet in terms of natural wines, because most wines produced were basically conventional high intervention wines, and we wanted to do something to actually encourage the whole country. There was a good deal of local grapes. The whole trend of growing local grapes back then, 5-10 years ago, but then none of it was made in like natural style. So basically, didn't know what the grape was, because if you add yeast, if you add this, if you add that, it kind of masks the whole thing. So we went around, and Crescio specifically went around wineries which we saw as great potential, and said, well, why don't you try this? Why don't you try that? Why don't you try lower intervention? This was, like a half a decade back. And basically people understood that, and also looking at the salon that we do, also looking at Raw, they saw that there was a whole industry behind this, and there was marketing and commercial potential. And today, growing local grapes is something that's a given. Nobody grows Chardonnay or Cabernet anymore. And people are replanting with new varietals, like the ones you have in front of you. So it's a kind of an ongoing work, but there's a very kind of firm, Crescio, I would say, there's a very firm movement towards like replanting like local varietals, right?
There is, but you know, like what's happening in Croatia, it's a shame. Like we have just a bunch of tourists coming there drinking local wines produced for them during the tourist season. So I really dread that, because it's such a great place. Like the wine potential is insane, and the Czechs and Slovaks have kicked our ass years ago. So I was put in this situation where
in what way?
We were at a salon and in Tabor in Czech Republic, they have 140 growers from Czechoslovakia. You know, we have five or six that we can present to this market. So I truly helped from finding people selling amazing wines, even from like the side of the road of bottles. I gave them a chance, pick them, make labels for them, and bring them here and show them to people that accepted them. And we now are growing a substantial business with promoting these wines and giving these people a chance to go back to the land and, you know, not to go and go back to these villages. And they see the future where nearly we have, especially in my region, we went from 200 hectares of one of the most iconic terroirs to 20, you know. So people are now looking at it like, this guy just got here, and all of a sudden, like, the wines are everywhere, and you know, and they're thinking like, oh, maybe I'm gonna do it, and you know, and they're calling me and saying, oh, this guy is gonna compete with you. I open my doors for everybody. Right. I really want people to come in and like be my competition, and I want a force of these wines around, and I'm supporting it and importing it and as well, and I'm trying really to do my best with my wines as well.
But is that happening? I mean,
definitely.
As years go by,
we now import, I don't know, 5-6 wineries. I help make wines in 2-3. I consult on other people. Right. We have wineries that make organic wines, but they don't know, they don't have a market of how to sell those organic grapes and produce them in a way that would be acceptable as a natural wine. I tell them, well, listen, you're doing everything right. Just put 10 milligrams of sulfur instead of 100. You know, it will be the same thing. The wine.
Is that just because they don't know better?
Because they have an enologist that told them so. Because you know, my wines, when when I go to a national board, they say to me it's cloudy. Then you know, I just go to the supermarket, buy a cheap wine, and pass the test. So you know, they're afraid. They don't know. We have no export market, and we actually created an export market. you know? And in the time of like coronavirus, where everybody, where nobody came in the numbers like they used to in Croatia, it was a problem. And I told them for years, we have to be able to sell wines outside of this country. You cannot only have one market, and you can have an earthquake, you can have another virus or something. We will lose against everybody, you know? And making inexpensive supermarket wines from terroir like us, it's a shame. You cannot do that. You know, we have Chile, we have Argentine producers selling wines for 2-3 euros at supermarkets. They will destroy our business if we don't change and produce only really high quality wines, at least from the terroirs that are unique, you know?
There's an incredible thing if you drive down coastal Croatia, if you just get a car and you drive down the coast, is you pass this road, which is like the main road. It's not a highway. It's like a fast road, which goes just by the sea, by the ocean. And you have people by the road selling wine in like plastic containers of like a liter or 5 liters. That doesn't happen anywhere in the world. I've traveled like almost all wine growing regions. It doesn't happen like ever. And this is what we wanted to tap into. These people making like really high quality wines, barely making a living selling to tourists who are not ready to pay more than $5, which is what you would pay for a high quality wine in Croatia from grapes from historic vineyards like Vinas Mora, like these guys. This was just sad. And we were like, Okay, you know, you're based in New York, I'm based out of Europe. We have to do something. We actually went to this grower by the road, that grower by the road, said, where do you buy grapes? You want to sell us grapes? Where do you buy grapes? Do you want to sell us grapes? And this is how these wines actually came to be. So basically, you're looking at like a parallel economy to X number of families in Croatia that these wines are supporting right now.
All right, so let's finish up these two wines. Can we get started pour the next two wines? While we're segueing and they're pouring, any questions on the wines? Is there any tasting questions or informational questions? All right. So tell me the next two wines that we're going to be pouring out. So either drink them or dump them in your discard cup.
Okay.
Okay.
We go now, man. Yeah.
So I'll talk about the third wine here. It's the wine I actually... So me and Alan Bibic are very good friends. He has a tremendous estate. He's a grower that really changed a lot in the modern Croatian winemaking and has really changed his ways of thinking about wine. He was basically making these big modern era wines before and, you know, score points wines kind of type of deal. And he realized that was too much stress and he realized he didn't want to be a part of that world. And about 6 years ago, I came into the cellar and I saw a drastic change in the wines. He also has lost his market in Croatia because he doesn't make this primary fruit only, cold fermentation wines anymore. Also yeasted, he's stepped away and he lost his market. And he asked me like, you know, what should I do? And I said, let's go around the cellar. Let's see what you have. And maybe we can work on something. So a lot of these wines are coming at incredible value because they really are. He priced them differently in for his market there, and I pushed him. I said we should really sell these wines and start with a new story. Opol is a wine that he is a specific character, sometimes hard to deal with, and I went to the cellar 8 times to come up with an order because we have all these amazing wines sitting there. And I said, I don't know, like, where are the wines? I need to see the bottles that we finalized. And at some point, I just took the pipette and I went around the cellar and I blended this wine. And it's a blend of white and red. It's something that I do in my winery. I said, I'll do something what I have at my estate just for fun. And I'll see how it goes. It ended up being great. And we bottled it. And it's basically the kind of like the base of you see in Alante. Which are the Bebit Maraština. There's a little bit of Muscat, the Alexandria here, and there is Plavina, which is a local varietal here. So just a nice little kind of like co-ferment, but co-blend.
So, right.
Yeah.
Is this Is this the first vintage of the Opal that you've made?
This is the first vintage we've done, and
you will continue to make it. I gather the blend would vary.
Yes. Exactly. But it's a style of wine that has been always present in this area.
All right. So let's get a second wine in everyone's glasses. What's the next wine we should have in front of everyone?
The second one is a variety called Plavina, another local grape, and up to like 5 years back, it was just a grape that was like not on anyone's radar, used basically for blends and just for quantity, to be honest. Another grape that was like a tier two or tier three grape even in ex-Yugoslavia. Basically, you wanted to produce en masse and sell to the cooperative. And then what you wanted to do was get the grapes like as late harvested as possible. The content of alcohol would drive the price you would get. And the grape almost got forgotten. People used to like replant. Such a shame. A beautifully like thin-skinned grape, beautifully light blue. Plavina means blue in Croatian slang, so hence the color of the skins. Thank God, today it's having a bit of a comeback. The way that Domaine Bibic does it is very different from anyone else. It's not burdened by oak. It's not burdened by being too late harvested. And again, you're getting like I think a beautifully textural, lightly structured wine. Some people kind of compare it to a bit more sudden Pinot Noir. I think it has a unique character of its own, just a beautifully light and textural wine.
Which grape is the grape that genetically ties to Zinfandel?
That's a different grape called Plavac Mali.
Okay.
That's a different one, yeah.
My bad. Just wanted to make sure. All right, so that's the Plavina, and we discussed the Opal. Does everyone have it in front of them? We're all poured out.
Again, quite a unique, I'm just tasting it now, quite a unique expression of the grape. You wouldn't really find, Chris, I don't think you find such a beautiful expression of this grape in any other winery in Croatia.
They really have the terroir for it. It's yeah. A place that, this is the... Really, the story of this area, and Alan has a tremendous vineyards, definitely of these varietals.
This episode is brought to you by 818 Tequila. 818 creates their tequila using traditional methods at a family-owned and operated distillery in Jalisco, Mexico. 818 is created from fully matured blue agave from the Los Altos and Valles regions of tequila. It is then slow-cooked for over 30 hours, extracted using traditional Tahona wheels, distilled twice in copper pot stills, and aged in American and French oak barrels. This process creates the best-tasting, highest-quality tequila possible. Their tequilas have received over 20 blind tasting awards. They strive for excellence in every sip. 818's Blanco is sweet and smooth, with undertones of tropical and citrus fruits. Their Reposado is soft and balanced, with notes of caramel and vanilla. Their Añejo is elegant and velvety, with crisp herbal notes and a warm vanilla finish. Visit drink818.com to learn more about their tequila and find it near you. 818 Tequila, imported by 818 Spirits, Manhasset, New York, 40% alcohol by volume. Drink responsibly.
Hearst Ranch is a proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. The Hearst family has been raising cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of California's Central Coast for over 150 years. Piedra Blanca Rancho in San Simeon is the original Hearst Ranch, founded by George Hearst in 1865. George's son was the famous publisher William Randolph Hearst. In addition to being known for building the iconic Hearst Castle, William was, like his father before him, an avid rancher. In his words, "I would rather spend a month at the ranch than any place in the world." Thanks to one of the largest land conservation easements in California history, a joint effort with the California Rangeland Trust, the American Land Conservancy, and the state of California, the working landscape at Hearst Ranch will be preserved forever. Learn more about Hearst Ranch at HearstRanch.com.
So let's talk about vineyards. Let's talk about the vineyards, farming practices. You know, we talked about it a little, but we discussed the fact that the region is steeped deeply in history, you know, back to before Christ, Romans, and all that. So there's been a lot of vineyards that have been around a long time. Talk to me first about the farming practices. You had alluded to the fact very low intervention, but you're talking about older vineyards. I want you to talk a little about, and this is a general question, so you could specify, vine age. You know, most of these wines are not from young vines, which is a beautiful thing. And farming practices, you know, does climate dictate that you don't have to do much, you know, as far as, you know, herbicides, yeah. But none of that, right?
Yes. Like I said, the climate dictates, the farming. We have, you know, every growing region has its own issues. If in my vineyards in the north, you cannot escape the vines, you know, because climatic changes, the peronospora, humidity are all things that we don't really see here. We really see different things. We see too much sunshine. Sometimes we see, you know, we have lack of water. And we see all these things that are issues of today's climate change. Luckily, we have this. This terroir still has an incredible diversity because we are in a proximity to the two mountain ranges that roll down some cold air and really make a big difference in the acidity. You see, these wines all have very bright live acidity. So this is something that is a savior for everybody that makes wine. The farming it's very minimal. I would say, you know, the minimum spraying here, maybe Alan, I know he sprays maybe twice a year with maximum copper sulfur, or that is it. There's really not much need. Sometimes, not even one time, depending on the vintage. And for us, it's really an issue, you know, spraying on the grapes in a very warm place in a. The sulfur component definitely dehydrates a lot of this, a lot of the grapes, and it doesn't really perform well. It's also like when you can not spray, when you can spray the almost nothing or nothing, it's ideal for us because it's really dries down the soil even more. Yeah, so that's in my experience what I see. I see people that are spraying; their soils are very, very dry. You know, and in a place like this is a huge issue. So we're trying to work with at least of, you know, some sort of a more alive soil as much possible. Only that explains.
No, it does. What about picking the grapes? Everything is hand farmed. Is it hand farmed because that's the best way to do it, or you can't and don't want to put machinery in there?
There is everything is farmed by hand. I mean, picked by hand. This vineyards I will show you. I'll pass my phone around. You will see these vineyards here. This is extreme. You cannot. It's really hard to walk here, let alone farm anything. You know, so you can't. It's just like you're gonna slip and fall, cut yourself. There's like snakes. You know, this place is insane. You would have to take. You would take one generation to plant these vines here. It would some of the vineyards. It would take 5-6 hours on the donkeys to get to the place. And then if you caught bad weather, you would have to sleep in this, you know, man-made like bungalows out of stones, and you know, you're lucky you'll be alive the next day. A lot of people have, like, you know, had God knows what kind of issues to survive the night, from thunders to everything. I mean, it was really brutal. We're talking about an extremely poor place here. We, especially my terroir, this until 1963, we had no electricity. You know, like my stepdad grew up with no electricity and water at some points when he was there. It was people only, you could, the only source of food was fish. That's it. You know, so if you go to the people there, we all find it charming that all these amazing seafood restaurants, but nobody wants to eat fish there. You know, like we all eat meat. You know, we all eat like lamb on the spit. If you have somebody's birthday, right. That's it. You know, you call somebody for a beautiful, large branzino, no one's coming. You know, so
tourists
are coming. That's right. That's it. But everybody that grew up there grew up very, very poor. And the only way of how to the survival was growing grapes. And selling these grapes to actually other markets in barrels, it was a very important growing region. But the prices were never there to support the effort of what had to be done in order for this to survive. So that's why we went from 200 hectares to 20 hectares. Soon as the tourism has started, soon as we connected the roads, soon as the electricity came, it was over. And everybody started planting olive trees instead of vines because it's much easier to go to the olives than to the wines. So and also the lack of knowledge how to produce good wines, the lack of cellar techniques, the lack of air conditioning.
I want to talk about that. You know, we talked a little about farming. We also talked about vine age. Has there been plantings in the last, you know, 3, 5, 10, 15 years just to get some of the varietals that you want in there? Or you're basically bringing back errant vineyards and, you know,
not with Bibich, actually, because he had quite a few different plantations. The first one, well, the second wine you have, this is a 50-year-old vineyard. And then the rest ranges from like 25 to 35 years. So you really see like a very mature, possibly the best age vineyard. And as Kresha said, I mean, growing grapes was a means to survival. It was a means to feed the family. These people, like looking at 30, 40 years back, they were by no means like wine growers with like a world perspective. They didn't have like phones and stuff. They grew grapes because it was just one of the farming things they did. So they were even not specifically wine growers. They had animals, they grew vegetables. So this is what we're looking at. I mean, also, in most cases, well, in a lot of cases, especially with Kresha's wines, which you'll taste later, so I didn't want to get much into that, they built like small claws, which today, you know, very famed in France, but in where Kresha farms, claws were actually a way just to protect, just a natural way to protect grapes, and people were self-taught, or life taught them, or nature taught them what to do. And this is what they did. Like literally, they had no contact with, if there was a vineyard in land, they had no contact with like the major city. So they needed to get on a, well, donkey or cart or something or whatever. So yeah, I mean, a lot of these vineyards, just they have like a few decades on them. And I think it shows in the wines, definitely.
Let's talk about winemaking and cellar practices. It would seem obvious to me that if you're low intervention in the fields, that you're going to carry that into the cellar. So talk to me about winemaking, cellar practices, but let's talk about, you know, vessels that you're fermenting in, aging in. You know, this would point towards indigenous yeasts.
I mean, there's like a pre-Second World War thing and then a post-Second World War situation where... a lot of grapes, local grapes, were pulled out following Second World War, and then internationals were planted. This kind of syncs with what happened in the world in a way, where you had the rise of the chemical industry and the rise of the enologist and whatever. So basically, you had a change of practices towards a more modern winemaking in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s.
We're about to change that. So,
why?
You know, it's just like obviously, wine is we promote organic farming and all of these things because it's better. Right. You make better wine from it, and with native yeast, you make better wine. Whether it's selected yeast, that's period. We don't, you know, if it was the other way, we probably wouldn't be sitting here. You know, we wouldn't have this festival. So, you know, for us is a, obviously, I don't want to talk about like minimum intervention. I want to talk about really what we need to do to make good wine.
Well, let's talk about that. Yeah. I mean, these are highly macerated grapes, most of them.
Please,
right?
Lisa.
I want to ask, can I reframe the question a little bit?
Yes. Yeah.
So I think what you're really trying to do is use your grape. If I'm mistaken, correct me. But I think you're looking for your grape to express your terroir.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
So, and that would mean that in some ways, perhaps, I don't know, different grape varieties would then dictate different cellar practices. Okay?
Correct.
So, if I could dig a little deeper to say, what are you doing with different varieties in the cell? But you can go back and think of blood. But how are you trying to do encourage that terroir expression?
Okay,
so length of maceration.
Yes.
I mean, all.
I'll tell you in my case, okay? Because I come from this very unique vineyards, and I think it's our grape, which is called Babich. It is the main focus of what we do. We do single vineyard expressions. I basically wanted to make an expression of this grape, just like you do in Burgundy, just like you do everywhere else, to really show terroir and to almost just to minimize any kind of techniques on it. It's overly, the wine in today's climate, I believe they're overly macerated, overly worked, and they really, when I think of red wine, I think of red wine as I think of white wine. For me, the problem with, let's say, a lot of orange wines, they are too macerated, you start losing terroir. It's the same thing with red, you know? So I think of every vintage is different. But I really dialed back the macerations on Babich grape, which is a almost kind of much more like Pinot Noir than a Zinfandel. High acidity, beautiful aromatics, that all was lost in most cases. So I knew that, you know, with just being going around the cellar for the last 20 years, I knew that needed to be done. And it really hit the spot. It really started to sing. The wine expressed itself. Everybody talks to me, comes to me and says, oh, the terroir, the rocks, and all these things. It really less is more with what I try to do. I'm not trying to make light wines because it's a strength. I'm trying to make wines that really need to be done in order to express the grape. And most importantly, this terroir that is very unique. We need to be able to express the salinity in the wines. And that is the primary focus. You will see the vineyards after. But I have a wine that is also a different subject that comes from flatlands, and here I do a co-fermentation with white and red. So it is a continuous fermentation between 1 and 4 days because I really wanted to also have something that is light on its feet, and I believe the whites here are more powerful than the reds, and this kind of a mix of macerations really gives it a diversity in the wine. It really, it's an evolving process, and it's also an experiment, but it really proves to be working. You know, sometimes you are held up because of issues in the cellars. You have to fight your way, but there's always an idea. What we tried to really express this year was these single vineyards, vinifying everything in the same way. There's the same élevage for each wine, and it was a tremendous difference what we got. So we had a tradition of this area where people knew that some grapes were coming from this part and they would be more expensive than the others. They all knew that they never had names for it, you know, these places. So when I started to do this, I said, I'm going to make my own terroir. I'm just going to, you know, we don't have an AOC. You know what? I'll make it. And I'll call this that, I'll call this that, and I'll call this that, and we'll make wines from only these parcels, and we'll sell them around the world and see what it says. We were sold out in 4 months. Gone.
All right, so let me just set this up. We have less than 15 minutes left. So finish up the wines you have in front of you. Let's get the last couple of wines poured out, and we'll get into that a little more. I have a question for what happened? I have a question. Is this the first time some of you have tasted these wines? So a few of you have had these before. Okay. All right. So Crescio, the next wines are the Venus Mora, right?
Yeah, we actually have one more red.
Oh, okay.
Here.
Well, let's just quickly pour it. It's a Syrah.
Let's pour the Syrah. Let's discuss that, and then towards the end, we'll empty out one glass, and we'll talk about the last wine. So, Syrah,
I mean,
not one of the typical grapes that we've been talking about. Yeah, but not, set it up for this.
Not one of the typical grapes, but I mean, I don't want to take too much time on this. It's one of those grapes that was planted after the Second World War. Actually, what an amazing idea! It grows beautifully in the coastal Croatia, which basically is just pure Mediterranean, high temperatures, a lot of garrigue. I had a French lady coming to the table today saying she'd never tasted a Syrah like this. We have another one if you want to come and taste at the table. That was you. But I wanted to refer to a French lady as like she lives in like the south of Rome. It's like, I never had a Syrah like this, which it's actually quite true. So one of those grapes, international grapes that got planted post-Second World War, and Bibich decided to keep it. It just gives beautiful results. I wanted to refer also back to the winemaking technique question. I mean, don't be fooled. Most wines in Croatia are not produced in this way. They're very yeast-driven, wood-driven, awards-driven, decanter, awards-driven wines, which then is something which is used in marketing purposes to sell them. People don't really still understand the marketing point and the sustainability of just growing beautiful grapes in what is an amazingly beautiful terroir that doesn't need to be burdened by all the winemaking practices. There's just no need for that. Sadly, the enologist kind of consultant industry is quite strong in Croatia, even in international presence. But people like Croatia, we're working on changing that. There's no need. The terroir is so beautiful that you can literally do very little and express what is grown beautifully there.
So Syrah, not really one of the indigenous grapes of the region, right?
We just have it here.
So this particular Syrah vines were planted when?
This is a 35-year-old.
Okay, so they have some good vine age.
Yes, they have some solid wine age. And honestly, I think this will be a good continuation into Croatia's grapes. And into Croatia's wines. I think it's going to be a good scene.
In thinking about making the wine, is there any nod towards the Rhone or to any other region? Or you just think about what you want to make?
No, it's literally thinking what we want to make, how you will express the grapes in the best way. There's none, of course we drink Rhone, of course we kind of take example of that. But then again, it's just using the stuff that you have in the vineyard and just do the least amount of work to be able to express that terroir.
Right. And Croatia, the other wine that we're pouring?
Also, just for the Crno wines, we're curious to know what you think this wine costs. That's an interesting subject with this wine. It's a pretty good wine, I think.
So I'm going to guess that it's more on the inexpensive side than expensive, because you wouldn't ask.
It is inexpensive, but it's retail.
So what you're setting up is this is an incredible value
It's a definitely good value. It's a wine that costs like $14 at a store. So $14-$15. Anyways, to kind of like almost we have like last 5-6 minutes I think to finish up on my wines here.
We have time. Go ahead.
Barba is the first wine I needed to create. Basically, producing wine from this very single vineyard-minded concept, I also needed the wheels for this concept to survive. And I decided that I sourced some grapes from some of my friends from the lower slopes, for more of a green terroir, from more of a fertile soil. It kind of like I wanted to also have a different concept that is only in the Babic, where it's only these territories. So to me, also the label, often people ask, is this man on the label, is there for a reason? Because I think that in all of our stories about wine, we have this terroir concept, very serious stories. It's always very deep. And without the concept of a man, of humanity, all of this would be impossible. And this is an homage to somebody that has survived making wine in this incredible place for the last 70 years and holds some of the oldest vineyards and is still making this great wine. Every year I buy, even though I make a lot of wine, I still buy all of his production just to keep it at the house, because it's really a testimony to survival. He deserves to be on the bottle because of that. But it really is one of these dimensions of the terroir is also human, and it's very important to take that aspect. This is... Okay, go ahead.
No, finish.
This is it's a co-ferment of Plavina, which you had. Another grape called Lassin, which is a varietal that is absolutely beautiful. It's very much kind of like a deeper Pinot Noir, darker Pinot Noir kind of character. And then Debit and Maraschino, which you heard before. They're fermented in plastic vats. Everything is done manually in my winery. Everything is done by hand.
Why fermented in plastic?
It's just very simple and clean.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, I would love to have wooden fermenters if I could, but expensive. My first vintage, I spent all my money I had. I didn't know if I'm going to be able to sell any of this. Thank God people
bought
it. You know, but it actually, you know, it's not true. Polyethylene works, our tanks work very, very well for these wines. It's the best for what we also bought stainless steel, much more expensive. I'm going to get rid of it. Because for red wine, that what I do is red wine and with primary fruit, I want this fruit to express, with the fermentations in the polyethylene, there's much more aerobic. The wines are working the whole time. With stainless steel, you have a very stuck environment. The lees are not as active. Everything goes to the bottom. You have to work it a lot more. And in those polyethylenes, wines are moving. We see a lot more diversity in the wines, especially with those smaller tanks, about to, like, let's say 5,000 liters. You know, so I'm not a fan of stainless steel. It's very good for blending. It's very good for a lot of the, like, you know, simple white wines and also. But I really want my wines to be active during the fermentation, and I really don't want reduction, which stainless steel is very prone to give you. So it's something that I will definitely keep. And this is only aged in polyethylene tanks. The next wine you will try is aged in also in 30% old wood. So
wait, did we pour the?
No.
Okay, so we have one wine left. So make room for this wine, please. So set up this wine for us.
This is please come to my table. I couldn't bring all wines. You can try other single vineyards as well. I have very little of this wine. Marco had to bring it in the back because the customs and the
travel of the wine these days with all these disasters are very, very slow. So I was expecting my wines to be here, but they didn't arrive. They were supposed to come.
So kudos to you. This is a treat, because I said you don't have to pour this if you don't have a lot. But thank you to you bringing in and giving us an opportunity to taste it. So let's talk about it quickly.
Who's going to pour?
Can you guys help us pour this out? Thanks.
Can
empty out
if
the
anybody
glass.
Can empty the glass,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good.
Let's save the planet with washing everything all the time.
It's good. It's okay.
You want to pour, Chase? Yeah, just pour very small.
Yeah, that's all we have.
So that's all we have. So I'll also pass the phone around that you can see. Marco, you want to maybe?
Yeah.
So I'll show you the pictures of, it really explains a lot. It's really difficult to say this in many words. You will see these vineyards that are... You will see these vineyards that I spoke about here. So basically, this is the Kamen line. Kamen means stone in Croatian. It is a wine that comes... This is basically a single terroir wine. It comes from the higher altitude, about 200 meters above sea level, surrounded by sea. It is coming from average age of vines, about 80. It is more of a west-facing vineyards. Here, there's about 4 to 5 Celsius degrees difference, what you see on the bottom of the where my winery is located. So wines here are a little bit deeper. They are very mineral-driven. They are very low-yielding. To me, this is liquid stone. It's my definition of what this is. It's a... extreme
extremely poor soil. The expression here, like I said, in all the wines are the same of élevage, that I really want them to just be different of the and show themselves. I really don't change anything. There is 30% of old wood that goes into for only 3 months. I only keep it for a little part of micro-oxidation. It brings a dimension. The rest is polyethylene tank. Macerations are about 4 days. The sulfur is added just a little bit at the beginning. I really don't want any breath in my wines. So, and a very, very low amount. It's a, we cleared up. I went to the institute and they looked at me. I'd never seen something like this. So it's like it showed a zero. They said, if the lady drank the wine when I brought it from those capsules, and they usually get poison. She said, I must try this. Yeah. She drank my samples. It was crazy. And then a little bit of sulfur just before the bottling, basically at bottling. So we are looking at maybe like 15 milligrams total sulfur in this wine.
Even less.
Yes, go ahead.
Threshold, is it something that they used to do, blending white and red?
It used to be done not where I'm from, because they didn't have any white here. So we are basically this Vinus Mora is based on these Babbage grapes, and it was we didn't have the terroir name for it. We didn't have an appellation for it, but it was known as in the history to only plant Babbage in these rocky soils. So there's no other varietal that performs even close as good as to this. So Babbage is a varietal that is also not a very good varietal. It's not high quality. It's not like a Cabernet that it gives you a high yielding high yield. It really needs to be pulled back a lot in order to achieve quality. And here in these soils, it's an ideal combination. I always say the old people, the elders, really knew best what they were doing. And it's anybody that made a difference in the vineyards and with growing, the modern enologists, the modern growers came, and the agriculturalists, they ruined everything they've done. And everybody was, you have to listen to the old people. So only those vineyards that are planted in those systems, 1 meter point, 20 centimeters, exactly, one from another, is the only way how to work here. Everything else is stressing the vines and stressing the soil. And this is truly that technique only here, what you see in this wine.
Krishna, if you remember, I just remembered something. You remember we read a book, that big encyclopedia of grapes by a French author. And I can't remember the name, but it was like all the grapes of the world. It's like really well written in French. And he said, well, Babbage, very mediocre grape, very mediocre wines. Which, I mean, you can taste what you have in a glass, but I guess that was a consequence of him actually tasting modern Babbage grapes and how they are grown modernly, but like consulted by enologists standards, which is contrary to
different wine made differently.
He's tasting grown the wines
differently, made differently.
Exactly. Coming from a fertile soil, nothing to do with this. Nobody, here you would have to know somebody, and you would have to go to someone's house to taste the real deal. Nobody has done this on a scale like we did, and it was very difficult to find
but
something.
But credit to you guys, that's what's happening there now. And I think exciting things ahead. We have to wrap up because we're at the end. But I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions. We talked about Dalmatia being a Mediterranean climate. You talked about how the locals don't eat much fish or whatever. But let's talk about these wines, because hopefully from this, people will go out and seek these wines. Let's just talk quickly about food pairings. It's a very general question, but we can relate to particular wines.
The pairings are people eat I would say grilled fish with this kind of wines, the red wines. They don't have any whites. I would say some of the grilled meats and stuff like that. They are very simple. Very simple cuisine. And also,
Marco?
I'd say, talking from a perspective of working in Asia for like 4 to 5 years.
Good with Asian food?
Yeah. It could, like, skin contact here, you could go well
it
with
has
Asian
the body.
Food. You can do that. Also with pork, you can do that. But about that, you can go with spicy food. I think that could actually work really well. Opal here, too. So I think there's quite a diversity. I mean, in Croatia, things are quite straightforward, but as you expand to like cuisines of Asia and then Mexico, I think these wines actually pair really well with the freshness they have. I think, and very good substance. I think they pair really well with the diversity of foods, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, we want people to drink these wines with food. So lastly, how available are these wines? We're in New York, so I'm not worried about
outside. I just arrived here. They're in a lot of stores. We have them in I would say major, you know, retailers. Single vineyard wines are not yet for me.
Okay.
They didn't arrive yet. But if anybody wants to come to the table, you can taste them, and I think people will buy them. So
These wines are imported by Zev Rovine?
Yes. Also.
So Zev has a very good network of distribution in New York. So if we're talking New York, if you seek these wines out, what about if people want more information? Are there any websites or any particular place to go?
Our website has it.
Zev, okay.
I think that there's also a good point in terms of sales globally. If you've traveled a lot, and I don't think you've seen much of Croatian wines on the wine lists. That's basically because they've been produced in a very commercial style. But you'll see these wines on the list now as something which is more like food pairing oriented and just a pure expression of the grape, not oak burden. So I think you're going to see quite a lot of Croatian wines from us and then from other of our colleagues around the world as you travel.
All right. So please seek these wines out. If your curiosity is not piqued now, then I don't know what it's going to take.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yes,
that's the Barba. I was going to point that out. It's unlike any of the other wines.
It's aromatics from the white. It's really tropical. I call it Mediterranean. It's the herbs and the garlic that you find. It truly is a postcard from the Mediterranean, I call it. You know, it's something that comes from mainly the white part of the grapes, especially from this Marastina varietal, which is a strain of Malvasia. And it's I really seek for that. I really want that top end to be there. This is a wine that it's very different than from the others. It's made every year. I want it to be Barba every year. And these wines are very terroir wines. They're always just the same thing. But Barba is kind of like this Mediterranean style of wine. And I every year I kind of like tweak it to be this. I really try to hit the percentages of white and red. Like I want to have this expression that is. That is in this vintage, something that shows well.
All right, we got to wrap up. I got to let you guys go. I want to thank Krešo Petreković and Marko Kovač for joining us on the Speaker's Corner at this year's Raw Wine 2022. Good to be back drinking with other people and in person. You can't beat that. We thank you guys for sharing these wonderful wines. It was certainly a treat.
Thank you, Sam.
I'm Sam Ben Ruby from the Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. Tune in and thank everybody for taking time to sit with us. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.